Rhys slept well. The ship's gentle roll a muted reminder of his time at sea aboard the Beneteau. That voyage seemed like years ago now. He dreamt of the ocean, how it offered him refuge, tested him, and delivered him to what? He wasn't yet sure. Voices passing outside the hatch of the small stateroom rousted him from a deep slumber. Rhys stared silently into the pitch-black darkness and tried to remember where he was. After realizing that he hadn't failed Buds and been assigned to the fleet, he swung his feet onto the deck and felt for his Navy-supplied shower shoes with his toes. The ship's company had left a package of new white T-shirts and a blue coverall jumpsuit for him on the bunk. He couldn't bring himself to put on the coveralls, but he put on one of the fresh T-shirts and pulled on the Cry multicam pants that he'd worn on the Albania op. He brushed his hair back with his hands as best he could and put on a sweat-stained Padres cap he'd found under the bed. Heading out into the passageway and into the bustling heart of the ship during the morning watch, Rhys asked directions to the wardroom and wandered in that direction. Navigating the internal passageways of a ship had never come easily to him. Rhys eventually found it with the help of a seaman apprentice who looked about 12, and he wasn't surprised to see Ox already there when he arrived. He caught some strange looks from the khaki uniform-wearing officers seated at one of the tables and begrudgingly took off his hat. He wasn't sure why he worried about it, the normal decorum of the officer's mess having already been shattered by the pasty white former Army NCO clad in a tight T-shirt and a pair of black Ranger panty PT shorts, far too much of his anatomy on full display. The ship's officers apparently knew better than to say anything to the barrel-chested operator sitting by himself. "Ox, you still wearing those Speedos in public? I think there's a regulation of some sort against that in the 21st century military. You realize there are women on Navy ships now, right? You remind me of the old chiefs at Coronado who were still rocking UDT shorts when I showed up as a new guy." "Nothing more comfortable, brother. I'm not giving these things up. Get some coffee and come join me." Ox motioned to an urn full of the Navy's best jet fuel on a table nearby. Rhys filled his cup and doctored it carefully with sweetener and milk, a bit disappointed at the lack of honey. "Good thing they do have women on ships now, Rhys, otherwise you'd have to drink it black, like a man." Rhys gave his friend the one-finger salute over his shoulder, then took a seat at the round table, where his friend read a computer printout of a news story through a pair of half glasses. "What's happening in the world today, Ox?" "Well, it says here that some Albanian commandos killed the most wanted terrorist in the world in a firefight last night."
"No kidding. Good for them."
"Yeah, pretty crazy. Says here in all that chaos, somebody put a single round through his lungs."
"Wow. Kind of sounds like when Colombian forces killed Pablo Escobar," Rhys said with a conspiratorial smile.
Ox looked at Rhys over his glasses. "Very similar, my friend. Very similar."
"Are we the only ones up? What time is it?"
"Ha! It's 09:30, Rhys. Everyone has been up for hours. Freddy and Vic are off somewhere doing admin, and Django is in the gym staying huge. He must have eaten a dozen eggs this morning. You need some chow?"
"No, I'm good with coffee for now."
Rhys drank his Java in silence, still trying to clear his mind from the fog of sleep while Ox droned on about something. 20 minutes later, Vic Rodriguez walked into the wardroom dressed in pressed casual clothes, showered, shaved, and looking sharp.
"Good morning, Mr. Rhys. Ox, glad to see that you haven't moved in 2 hours."
"Just catching up on the news, boss."
Rodriguez rolled his eyes.
"Rhys, is this a good time for us to talk?"
"Good a time as any, I guess."
"Let's head topside. Top off your coffee if you'd like."
Rhys nodded to Ox, who flashed him a grin as he refilled his coffee, and followed the agency man toward the upper deck. The irony was not lost on him that, as a career naval officer, he had to follow a former soldier to find his way through the ship.
Vic led him through a hatch and onto the windswept flight deck. A crew member nodded to him and pointed toward the stern. This had obviously been arranged ahead of time. The two men stopped aft of the ship's superstructure, a few feet from the deck's edge, the chained railing the only thing between them and a long drop into the Adriatic Sea below. They were mostly out of the wind, but it was still present enough that no one standing more than 10 feet away would be able to eavesdrop on their conversation, and no member of the ship's crew was within anything close to that distance. They had complete privacy. Rodriguez got right to the point.
Reese, I want to thank you for what you've done. Because of your efforts, the most wanted terrorist in the world is a corpse. Global markets are reacting to the news as we speak. We had a deal. As far as the U.S. government is concerned, you're a free man.
I appreciate that, Vic. I get the feeling there's a but here, though.
You're right, Reese. There's a but. You don't owe us a thing, but we sure could use you. I am offering you a job, no strings attached. You'd be a green badger, a contract guy. You know what that means. It's not a bad deal, and you get to see this thing through.
Reese took a sip of coffee and stared out at the choppy green water on the horizon. Rodriguez continued.
Okay, I guess you're going to make me sell it. You know what kind of evil is out there. You've been in these countries. Amin Nawaz was a big get for us, but someone is going to take his place tomorrow, smarter and even more determined. We need people we can count on to hunt these assholes down to the ends of the earth. And here's the other part. That plan that you came up with to flip Mo and use him as a pseudo-terrorist? It's brilliant, but I need you here to run it, or else it'll get fucked up. You know that. Major Farouk, Mo as you call him, is on his way into Iraq with Landry right now. This isn't over by a long shot.
Reese nodded and took another sip of coffee, glad his friend was still alive and well.
Listen, Reese, I don't know you personally, but I know your reputation. I've read all your evals, fit reps, and medal citations, but more importantly, Freddy and Ox think the world of you. Come work for me. You do what you're good at, and I deal with the politics and the red tape.
Reese looked Rodriguez in the eye. You really think they're going to let me go? They're just going to forget about all the people I killed?
Reese, all I know is that I can't protect you if you're not under my wing. Give me a few months on the job, focus on the mission, and I'll provide top cover. If you decide later that you want to walk, I won't try to stop you.
Reese was silent for a full minute as he weighed the different scenarios. He started to say no, but stopped himself, looking out to sea, remembering the voyage from Fishers to Mozambique, his family, the tumor, and Katie. In the end, he made the decision for Mohammed, his friend with whom he had shared the bond of combat. This wasn't over. Mo had been played. He'd been played by a sociopath who had found his way into an intelligence agency that gave him the freedom to feed his sick fantasies, and somebody, possibly in the agency itself, was running that sociopath. This wasn't over. And Reese couldn't walk until it was. He couldn't leave Mo halfway through the operation. To Reese, that was the same thing as leaving him behind on the battlefield. Vic was right. Reese needed to see it through.
You forgot to mention something, Vic.
Oh, what's that?
That you read my psyche, Val. That you knew I'd say yes.
Vic smiled.
Well, true. There is that.
Reese paused. I'm saying yes to finishing this operation. And then I'm out. Vic Rodriguez smiled again and extended his hand.
Welcome to the team, Reese. Surgery is planned either at Bethesda or at your clinic in La Jolla as soon as this is over. And by the way, you've got some money coming your way. We made it a condition of you coming on board that you got to keep the reward money for Nawaz. It was coming from the British government, so we worked it in as a term of your employment. It's a sizable chunk. Figured you could use it to get a fresh start.
That might just about cover my old land cruiser, and I owe more than a few people beers. I do have one request to make, though.
What's that?
I need you to track down a phone number for me. After a pause and some clicks and beeps as the Iridium satellite phone connected, Rhys heard it begin to ring. He was more nervous than he thought he would be. He hoped she'd answer the strange number.
Come on, pick up.
He thought of all the times he'd called Lauren on the same type of phone, the same clicks and beeps followed by the strange satellite-transformed voice that made loved ones sound like aliens from another world. He'd always told her that everything was okay and not much was going on, even as he looked up at the night sky following a mission in which everything was not okay. No matter how tired he was, he always made time to call, feeling it was his responsibility to use the technical advantages afforded him that were not available to his late father in Vietnam or his grandfather in World War II.
This is Katie.
Pause.
Katie? Yes? Hello, anyone there?
Even through the Iridium satellite link, he could detect her slight hint of an accent that most people wouldn't even notice.
Shit, what am I, in junior high? Hello?
She said again. Paralyzed, Rhys remembered her on her knees with debt cord twisted around her neck, with the thumb of a SEAL-turned-CIA operative-turned-mercenary on the detonator.
Rhys, how did you know Ben didn't have that detonator connected? How did you know he wouldn't blow my head off?
Shit, Rhys said out loud, hitting the end call button. I didn't. Chapter 54. Kurdistan, Iraq. September. Landry thought he was going to die. As whatever drugs they'd given him wore off, panic began to set in. It didn't help that he was beginning to experience withdrawal symptoms from the cocktail of recreational and prescription drugs that had become his mainstay. His wrists and ankles were bound, there was tape over his mouth and eyes, and he was wrapped in something heavy. The heat was stifling, and the pillowcase over his head only exacerbated the claustrophobic conditions. The only sounds he could hear were those of tires on various combinations of asphalt, gravel, and dirt as the vehicle traveled for what seemed like days, his brain having no reference points to maintain his sense of equilibrium. He dry-heaved repeatedly from motion sickness, his clothing soaked in sweat and urine. His brain raced to process what had happened. He lived a paranoid existence as it was, expecting betrayal at nearly every moment. He struggled to make sense of what had gone wrong. Betrayed by Mo, but to who and for what? Had Mo found out he wasn't really a CIA asset, continuing his work for the United States government he'd started in Iraq? This was more than misery. This was pushing Landry into the land of the insane. He squinted his eyes shut, trying to make this nightmare end, only to open them to the darkness of the tape and hood. His muffled screams the only outlet for what had turned into an anxiety attack without end. The van accelerated over gravel, made several sharp turns, and finally came to a stop, brakes squeaking. The driver was speaking to someone outside, and Landry heard the doors open. Whatever he was wrapped in was jerked from the vehicle. He landed on the ground with an unceremonious thud and rolled sideways as the rug unraveled. The effect was dizzying. Landry attempted to gasp for air, thwarted by the tape across his mouth.
It must be night,
he thought, feeling the cool air against his skin. He could hear the distant hum of generators. The scrape of a metal door penetrated the darkness, and he was carried face down by what felt like four men into a building of some kind. The footfalls of boots sounded as if they were walking on a concrete floor, and he heard various doors open and shut in front of and behind them. No voices. The movement stopped, and he was dropped onto the hard floor, his chin splitting on impact. He heard a strange sound that he couldn't identify until he realized it was a pair of EMT shears cutting the clothing from his body. The room was freezing cold, and he felt increasingly chilled as his skin was exposed to the air. His boots were pulled from his feet, and he was left totally naked on the cold, hard floor. The door slammed shut, and hands still bound with zip ties and duct tape, he curled up in a ball, shivering and convulsing, on the verge of madness. Chapter 55. Over the Mediterranean Sea. September. Their flight took close to 3 hours and nearly maxed out the V-22's fuel capacity. It was Reese's first time riding in the tilt-rotor aircraft, and though part of him thought it was an incredible feat of engineering, the almost 40-something part of his brain couldn't help but remember how many times these aircraft had crashed during development. He and Freddy sat in the folding seats that lined the walls of the aircraft's cargo bay, which, to Reese's untrained eye, looked like a smaller version of the Chinook's interior. The inside of the fuselage was covered in an endless tangle of wires, metal lines, and hoses like something out of some steampunk artist's fantasy. Reese thought of one of Ox's favorite sayings. If you get in a helicopter and it's not leaking, get ready to crash, because that means it's out of hydraulic fluid. He looked up to see whether anything was dripping. The marine pilots steered them over the open Mediterranean before going feet dry over Turkey and finally passing into the airspace of northern Iraq. Their landing at Erbil International Airport was conventional by Iraqi standards, unlike the dive bomber-like landings they'd all endured during approaches into Baghdad International Airport. The surface-to-air threat must be pretty light here these days. Their headsets allowed them to hear the chatter on the bird's intercom, which mainly consisted of the pilots conveying information to the crew chief riding with them in the cargo bay. It was all very routine. Reese was curious whether the Osprey would land vertically or horizontally, but due to the generous runway, it touched down like a traditional fixed-wing aircraft. Probably safer that way. After a short taxi, the twin turbine engines shut down, and the rear ramp was lowered. Reese and Freddy went forward to thank the pilots and crew for the ride before unstacking their assorted gear strapped to a pallet on the aircraft's metal floor. The crew chief helped them carry the kit bags and Pelican cases to the tarmac, where a white F-250 had pulled up behind the Osprey. A small group of Peshmerga troops, armed with SCAR-17s and dressed in surplus U.S. desert camo and black body armor, stayed by the truck, while a tall, blonde-haired American wearing jeans and a tan polo shirt approached, looking like he'd just walked off the Norwegian ski team. "Freddy, good to see you, buddy," the man said in recognition of Reese's partner. "Hey, Eric, appreciate the pickup. Meet James Donovan." "Donovan, huh? Okay, well, welcome to Kurdistan, James. Pleasure to meet you. I'm Eric Spurr. I've heard good things." Reese shook the man's extended hand. "Good to meet you as well. Let's get you boys loaded up and out of here. Your guest is waiting." Spur waved to the Kurdish troops, who moved quickly to help retrieve the men's gear and load it into the truck. Reese and Freddy insisted on helping. They both noticed that Eric left the work to the Kurds. They loaded into the crew cab pickup, Spur behind the wheel, and drove east through the city. "What's that?" Reese asked, turning in his seat to take in the huge fortress that occupied the high ground to his right.
"That's the famous Citadel of Erbil. They say it's been inhabited continuously since people first lived in this part of the world," Eric informed them.
"Good tactical position," Freddy observed. "Probably a good strategic one as well if it's been inhabited that long."
An hour east of Mosul, which had only